Hi, and welcome to the Cloud Computing Show, episode number 22. Today is our 2009 Cloud Trends wrap-up show, and I am really excited to have a roundtable of friends that we all met at the SF Cloud Club. And first is James Waters, Senior Manager of vCloud Solutions at VMware. James, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Gary.
We also have Brian Bukowski, the CEO of Citrus Leaf.
Good to be here, Gary.
Great to have you. And Adrian Cole, founder of JClouds.
Yep, good to be here too.
So what we did is we all brainstormed a list of topics that we felt were relevant for cloud computing in 2009. We put that all together. We did some mashup of it and came up with a list that we're going to run through today. I'm going to introduce some of the individual topics. We'll have one of us get into a little bit more detail, and then we'll jump into roundtable discussion, and we'll take it away. There is no particular order to the topics other than things that we felt were very interesting that we wanted to talk about. And we'll also have a complete list of the topics on the show notes for those if we don't get to everything today. So, James, why don't you kick it off with our API topic?
Sure, Gary. So topic number one we originally described as the rise of the API. And there was just some chatter on Twitter right before we got on here, people talking about lazy cloud providers that don't even want to provide an API. And I think that that's a little bit insane. And I think the reason that the API is so important is that so much of what we're doing with cloud computing is turning manual activity into code so that applications can start to assume a higher and higher level of abstraction. And that's a really simple comment, but you can see some really interesting happening with the API. You can see ISVs being built directly to the API. You can see a ton of new programming libraries that are all there and maintained to adapt to the API. You can even see things like Puppet and Chef, which are really starting to turn code assembly or application assembly itself into an API and do code. So you've got this huge wave of thou shalt do it in code going on with infrastructure. So I think that's like one of the big things in cloud this year.
Yeah, I agree with you, James. I think I've heard many times during our cloud meetups that if it ain't an API, it's not a cloud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, can you have a cloud service that doesn't have APIs? Let's ask the reverse question. No, you're shaking your head.
No, I call it the write scale test, I guess, which is if you can't deploy write scale on it, it's really hard for it to be considered a cloud, and they do everything through APIs.
Absolutely. Otherwise, it's just a rapid deployment of individual machines. That's not what I call cloud.
Right. But the APIs are getting more sophisticated, mm-hmm. right? And the APIs are now becoming almost the hook more so than the product or service. It's only as good as the gateway to it.
Yeah, I mean, notice when Amazon launched spot pricing, it was immediately available in API. So it wasn't like, hey, we have this new feature and it's coming out in the API 2 weeks from now. It was, you can go call this from API. A day later, there were websites dedicated to tracking the pricing. People were already talking about orchestrating programs to maximize lowest cost. It's just part of the whole deal.
I think spot pricing is actually far more subversive from an API perspective than other people think, because everyone now is going to have to build their code to deal with their instances going down immediately. So in the old days, you could have a reservation and you could know that your instance was going to be up for a couple of hours. Yeah. Now, to gain about a 3x price advantage, you have to deal with it goes down anytime. What does that do? It drives people to Amazon's queuing service. It drives people to Amazon's reliability APIs. So I think cloud spot pricing is about the most cloudy and subversive thing that's happened probably in the last 6 months, last half of this year.
Yeah.
So what are we going to see in 2010, do you think, on the API front? I mean, what do we look out for now, knowing that this is so crucial?
If I'm an ISV and I'm building a value-add piece of software for the cloud, I want to have either API integration right inside of what I'm doing or something pretty near and dear, like built on a JClouds or something like that. I think that that's the way to write software for the cloud.
I think you're going to find a lot of folks who are using APIs, like your Rate Scales, your CloudKicks, and your Instratuses, providing more APIs back, higher level APIs for orchestrating things. So I think folks who were using APIs will then be API providers, and I think you'll find a lot more services you can do in an automated fashion next year.
Mm-hmm. Great. Let's jump into the second topic. Brian, I think this is one that you'd originally suggested. And let's give people the 30-second intro of Citrus Leaf before we jump into this topic.
Sure. Citrus Leaf is a scalable cloud-oriented database. The idea behind it is that, well, today's databases, you typically have a monolithic database, and you might have to build a sharding system on top. You might build your own read replicas. Citrus Leaf makes it easy to just spin up individual instances as and scale your database as your data load and application scales.
Great. So we're going to keep this more generally focused, but since this next topic is near and dear to your heart, I just felt it was important to have that little disclaimer there. So the topic that you had suggested is that the NoSQL hype curve moderates at year end. And so fill us in on a little bit more detail there and kick off that topic.
Well, so say about NoSQL. So we've had Voldemort from LinkedIn from, what, 3 or 4 years ago. They were a part of AdMob, which was sold about a month ago. That is their core data storage engine for all their advertising. So we've got at least one fairly hyped company out there. Well, not hyped. I mean, they've got a great product built on top of a NoSQL platform. Cassandra has had a lot of extra addition of energy these days due to Rackspace's buying of them. Redis is still hanging in there, great little product. CouchDB was then included in the Ubuntu distribution as a way to synchronize all the different laptops of the world and synchronize your address book.
And the company just got funded to support Couch.
Cloudant. Is a couch company, and then MongoDB, which I think actually has a lot more real users these days. They got funded for $3.4 million, and I'm blanking on the name of their company.
TenGen, I believe.
TenGen is, yes, the Mongo company.
Okay, so wait a second. This laundry list does not seem to me a moderation of the hype.
Perhaps, but what's happening now is that the hype is past, and now all of us who are doing things in this space have to actually get our act together, put the products on the table, and create a usable system of data stores that solve real-world problems.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the excitement and the fanfare around the death of the relational database has sort of passed, and now we're into what are the practical applications and implementations?
Yes, that's my idea. I believe that we're past that point, and now we can all get down to building some great technology and applications on this.
So give us some examples of, you know, what are the two or three areas that we're going to see the greatest uptake of NoSQL implementations going forward?
Well, it's all going to be behind the covers, but where NoSQL methodologies shine is when there's a high level of personalized data. So whenever a person comes to your site, every single interaction with every single page has to get logged, interacted with, and feeds into the next page, and the next page, and the next page. That's when every single page view has a write and a read. And so you can't use a lot of the old SQL-oriented tricks of read caching, read caching, read caching. You have to have a system that interacts that fast to personalized experiences. I think that we're going to see it in search engines, but I think in general, just every experience that we have today on the web is just going to get more personalized. So we'll see individual companies saying, hey, I want to put my little green stripe on Dig, and they can't do it with their standard database. That's the little stripe that shows you your friends that have dug it. That's much more personalized than just, hey, you know, all the
right
people who have dug it.
Let me ask you
a question. Required a NoSQL database.
Let me ask you a question. Jump in, guys, if you want to comment. When you say personalization, creating this more personalized experience, but also the pressure to not necessarily rely on caching solutions, is that also is there real-time overlap there? I'm trying to distinguish between the impact of real-time on all the applications that we're using and the impact of personalization.
I talk to a lot of web architects who say, I can't keep up with the real-time commenting that we want to do. There's no way I can do that with traditional SQL. Because by the time I go to commit and to write, someone else has commented, and the system is just too slow. It would choke. So we do a sort of a NoSQL, hashing approach to that comment stream.
Absolutely. So it's really almost any kind of personalization of that sort, because people only wait so long. There's that the Google study, I think, that we've all internalized now about exactly how much traffic you lose for every millisecond
right
past a certain bar, right?
Right.
You're over 100 milliseconds, and so many of your users, and then you're past 3, that's where you get snap. And at 500, you get lag, and past 1,000, so, we've stopped talking, at least I've stopped talking about seconds, and everything's in milliseconds. How many milliseconds can you show this page in? That's what people expect and should expect, and to get personalization with that kind of real-time snap requires some changes in architecture.
But there was a blink at the end of this year where Amazon said, oh, by the way, we'll offer relational databases too. And I think that earlier in the year, a lot of the Amazon fanboys were more like, hey, this is all going to be NoSQL. Everyone who uses SQL, it's outdated. If you just write your app the right way, like a smart person would, which is where the ad hominem of the movement came in, if you were smart, you'd write your app like this. And a lot of that is going to start to die down, I believe.
I agree. I mean, I think what really happened was MySQL has one in the cloud so far. So we've got Rackspaces offering, Mosso offers MySQL. We've got Amazon now offering MySQL. So Azure doesn't.
Fathom is doing something MySQL related, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So where's Oracle? Oracle should have been somewhere, given their position 10 years ago, if we're starting to think about decade wrap-ups. There's nothing where Oracle is in the cloud right now that compares with where MySQL is. Oh, except that they're an Oracle product. But.
Right. Well, and there'll be a lot of changes there once this whole Oracle Sun MySQL thing gets sorted out. We'll save that for another show.
Sure.
All right, great. Let's jump into our next topic. And Adrian, I'm going to have you kick this off. But this one probably generated the most comments between us before we got together. And your topic headline was, is Salesforce so 2008? Where did that come from? And fill us in.
Sure. So where this came from is you know, earlier this year, I was going around Europe talking about JClouds. And one of the things that you end up doing in the beginning of 2009 when you're talking about anything cloud is informing people what cloud is. And so you end up with the Animoto story and the Salesforce story to try and get people to realize the difference between a platform and various parts of the cloud. And you know, and after I went through, you know, several cities and talking to folks, I really got tired of talking about Salesforce. And then I'm thinking to myself, will 2010 be the year that we can talk about cloud without mentioning Salesforce at all?
I don't know. Can we talk about real time without mentioning Twitter?
Maybe. You know,
I hope so. I did real comments.
it's mainly about, you know, how in my bringing up this point, I'm thinking about, is Salesforce a core piece of the cloud anymore, or are they just out in the periphery because the rest of the cloud has solidified so much that they're not so much the cloud story?
Now, when you say the cloud story, I mean, there's the cloud story as far as the application,
right?
The Salesforce.com application, which I use every day at work. And that, to me, is the quintessential cloud application, right? Sales guys, they're all over the place. They're remote already. What a perfect application to be in the cloud. Then there's the Force.com platform, which, it, to me, is like the walled garden extraordinaire. And so how do you define your comment in the context of sort of core application and Force.com platform?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, at the beginning of the year, I think you'd find a lot of blog postings about, you know, software as a service, platform as a service, infrastructure as a service. And then we start feeling like we're splitting hairs in March, April of this year. And people start saying, well, is this really platform as a service? Is this really? And now, if you think about it, people don't really talk in those terms so much anymore. I think that there's a lot of discussion about cloud services without putting them into certain boxes. And I think in the beginning of the year, we needed, in cloud discussions, a lot of talk like, oh, like, you know, Force or like Salesforce, you know, as far as, you know, helping people with a vocab.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is basically what I'm talking about. Can we talk about cloud now without needing to talk about
Flightcaster now. Yeah. Like, I would, if you look at cloud applications, I would much rather point to a Flightcaster these days.
Give us a background on Flightcaster for anyone who doesn't know about it.
So, I mean, you know, John Willis obviously broke this one open on a podcast in August with one of the architects of Flightcaster, so we're not breaking new ground there. But Flightcaster is a company that writes its web app in Heroku and its back end on Cloudera and EC2, and they're really short nodes. And what they do is they look at like 6 or 7 huge data points, and they crunch all of that up, and they say, well, given the weather and the pilot and the maintenance record and all these other variables, we can actually do an algorithmic artificial intelligence, and tell you that your flight's going to be 45 minutes late, so tell your wife. And mm-hmm. It actually works.
Right.
But that is all written in a very cloudy kind of way by two guys funded by only Y Combinator that did it in a couple months, that back core end data. And that's a real cloud story, which is they had that higher layer of abstraction, they had some cool tools, and they could crunch big data very quickly without having to assemble their own infrastructure.
Does that mean Salesforce is not a cloud story anymore?
Well, you know, I'm not a Salesforce hater by any means, but how many cloud posters that they have to put up at Dreamforce to convince us these days? I mean, talk about trying too hard. That was like epic fail in my mind in terms of trying too hard marketing. And the thing that I would say is this. I asked the question at the very first Cloud Club, and I said, will more cycles be consumed in 2010 by SaaS or by infrastructure as a service. And I wasn't sure kind of in the early summer time frame, but I would say now definitively that more cycles will be consumed by infrastructure as a service in 2010 than just pure software as a service.
Oh, that's interesting, because I think that ultimately companies really just want software as a service and, you know, don't really want to do all the infrastructure, but maybe that's going to take time.
I think the two issues are rather different. Everything is going to go software as a service. In some sense, the train's already left the station. If you're doing anything these days, you've got to have an API on the outside, and you've got to be able to interact with, you know, someone at a large company who's going to do X, Y, and Z, and they want some custom wrapper. Then the second question to me about cloud is, well, how can I make it flexible? How can I use these flexible infrastructures? How can I handle peak load? How can I get business flexibility to allow me to add cool features because, you know, some guy thought of it? That's to me what cloud is. I mean, software as a service and APIs like Salesforce, well, it's so 2008.
Yeah, and certainly if you start to call things like Google software as a service, my argument falls apart. But I guess what I mean is that there was this hype that all these packaged business applications were somehow going to be the big thing that was cloud.
Right.
And I've seen that trend be a little bit moderated.
Yeah, I buy that. My thing with Salesforce is I think that their application has become a little bit of an orphan child in the all the focus on the force.com stuff. And I just want a better UI for the day-to-day Salesforce.com CRM. So I'm waiting for that. Next topic. So, Adrian, you were saying maybe we don't talk about platform as a service versus infrastructure as a service versus software as a service as much anymore. But one of the things that we brainstormed ahead of time was, you know, is there room now between infrastructure as a service and platform as a service? Or are they just collapsing? And, of course, stereotypical example, AWS, we initially think of as an infrastructure service, but lo and behold, this database comes in, the Hadoop thing, the next thing comes in, lo and behold, they've got more and more of the stack. So, there's only so much room between user and bits on the disk. Are we now gone with that distinction?
I think it still makes sense. I mean, I think at the end of the day, I heard once, well put, that infrastructure as a service is something you think you can turn on and off. And so it's like, you know, is there something that you would otherwise plug into the wall? And I think for platforms, you know, those are definitely things that you make applications with. So when we talk about whether the terms are still useful, you know, buckets to club things into, yeah. Are there a huge amount of gray area? I think that's the case. I mean, right now you have Amazon's probably more platform than they are infrastructure now with a lot of their later releases.
All the add-ons, yeah.
You know, with all these add-ons. And I think that that's going to continue. I don't think that's going to slow down at all. What we have going in with a lot of their competitors are not necessarily tit for tat, which I'm kind of surprised at. You know, you see lots of releases from Amazon and unrelated releases from other clouds. So you do see some following with very, very basic things like images. I think next year is going to be the year of differentiation where it's not tit for tat. It's like this new feature, which is completely different than what the other guys are doing.
But the contrary point to that is some users or people who want to deploy cloud applications are looking for tit for tat, right? They want to have, if I've got this stack available on AWS, I want to at least make sure I can do it on Rackspace or GoGrid or Joyent or the next one or whatever.
You hear a lot of people say, don't use SQS if you're building an app. Don't do it because then you're stuck on Amazon. So a lot of these things that they're building are as much traps as they are features. So these are as much things that might try to lock you into using their specific implementation of it as anything else. And the other thing I would say is that it's early days in infrastructure as a service, and don't give up on it yet, because there are some things you can do at an infrastructure level in terms of rapidly scaling, availability, fault tolerance, that is very hard to do at an application replication layer. So I was recently talking to the CTO of Chef, and he said, look, you cannot build out new, fresh deployments of applications fast enough to scale with Oprah. Like, if Oprah starts sending a million people your way, you can't build server, crank, crank, crank. He said, you're going to have to replicate VMs. You're going to have to do things at an infrastructure layer, not an application layer, to spin up that fast. Just one comment, but I think that there's a lot of innovation left in the infrastructure service layer.
And I think the innovation is something we should really talk about it when we talk about what customers want. Do they want consolidation of features yet? And you know, I think that was very interesting when Brian went through a list of all the NoSQL options that had, you know, acquired some sort of monetary gain, and there's still plenty more that weren't mentioned. And so I'm really curious as to what is a consumer really interested in the cloud? Do they really want everyone to have tit for tat, or there's still a lot of room for diversity? I mean, what do you think, Brian?
At the database level, I think that people really do want some very basic functionality first. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, I've got something that refers to a person, and I've got this chunk of data, and it's over here, and I want complete reliability of my data. That's the first thing they want, and I'm talking to all of my potential customers, is how do I know, rock solid, you're going to have my data, I'm going to keep it, I can pull my data out. How do I make that data as reliable as it is with the incumbent databases? Mm-hmm. Once you get past that one feature, people are willing to talk about, you know, whether it's a JSON-based database or exactly how the MapReduce works or if you support PIG or not. But what they're really looking for first and foremost is a reliable object store. And that fits in with, I think, a new style of application development where we're going to pull back apart application logic into applications and let the databases be data stores. We had at one point to push application logic and programming logic into our databases for pure efficiency reasons. We had to move the code to the data. I think that what's going to happen slowly, which is to say probably in the next 2 years or so, is much more pulling that apart, and the databases will have to be reliable but simple stores.
So that comment makes me think that people then want a little more separation, a little more independent components for the flexibility of change going forward, right? If you buy into a platform and you try to compress that whole stack, you're buying into that for a long time to come.
I think there is. I think that, you know, a queuing system, I really just want to, I've got endpoints and I want to send my messages, and you know, that's my own business. And I've got data stores, I've got data blobs, I want to stick things in and pull them out reliably, and that's my own business. There should be, you know, four or five architectural components that the world will settle out to eventually. And I hope that people don't start cross-mixing them, because then we're all going to get confused. If it's a queuing system that's also a database, you know, oh, well, is it really compatible with my whatchamacallit? And then we get into fragmentation, and whenever that happens, technological change slows.
Okay, so what we're really saying is that things like queuing and object stores and such are going to be those standardized building blocks that you would expect clouds to offer. And then if they have, you know, various pigs or hives or other types of, you know, tools on top of them, those might be differentiators that people are more comfortable with choosing from. But if you change their object store out, then there's going to be a problem.
It has to be an object store with a very simple, common, easy-to-use interface.
Okay.
And I hope that we get to the point where we start finding some of those interfaces. I hope maybe next year will be the year of the API, where we get to the bottom of defining some of those.
Okay, I got a left field question. When's the right time to start building the object store migration tool?
Oh dear.
Are we there yet?
We're probably getting there.
Okay, good.
We're probably very close.
We'll save that for another show. James, let's go back to you. We've had two or three topics related to private clouds, but
yeah.
Give us your state of the private cloud and what's really taking place and what we need to know.
So private cloud is a really interesting phenomenon in 2009, because it kind of started off as sort of like the wrong thing to do. It was sort of like, you know, the spring, the summer, it was like, oh, private cloud, that's nothing. And I think the cloud has proven itself to be bigger than any one service provider's implementation of it, because private cloud has become such a real thing that will actually really happen in 2010. And I've talked to integrators doing private cloud integration. It's happening.
And give us your definition, just so we have a place to start.
Sure. I would say that a private cloud is a large collection of resources, infrastructure resources, that can be consumed in a programmatic fashion at scale in a way similar that you would consume a public set of those resources. So something that would comply with an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So for instance, you can use, not to shill, you can use the vCloud API in public, you can use the vCloud API in private. And that becomes really powerful. So if you've written a set of application or scripts to a public cloud on vCloud, bam, you're ready to go. Oh, all of a sudden you've stood up, you know, 10,000 servers internally. Your application is pretty much ready to function in the same way.
Right.
And that's what's really interesting about private clouds, is it's not just the outsourcing that matters about cloud, it's the method of assembly. And I think that that has proven to be one of the bigger things than just outsourcing in cloud, because we went through an outsourcing trend in the early 2000s where everyone was giving everything to IBM and hoping for the best. And that was what I'd call macro outsourcing. And the really interesting thing about cloud is that it's allowed micro-assembly outsourcing, but we've also learned the assembly part. Hmm.
So I was really a doubter of the whole private cloud initiative in the early days. It didn't make sense to me. I couldn't understand it. But as I've become more familiar with the workings of the public clouds and what they allow and don't allow as far as access to the underlying infrastructure, I have become absolutely convinced that private clouds are going to be necessary for certain companies and certain applications, because it's the only way that you can guarantee 100% use of the underlying resources. And in cases where there isn't a sporadic nature of demand up and down, but there is a reason to make something presentable externally long term, having access to the networking resources, having access to the raw storage resources with a moderate amount of growth here or there, I think is going to be really important. And it's not available now in the public cloud. The public cloud right now turns everybody into the lowest common denominator in terms of very lightweight access to the underlying infrastructure. And in my opinion, that won't cut it long term.
And the one other thing I would say is that if cloud is good enough to be – cloud is bigger than just public. And if it really is worth something, you'll see it. I mean, imagine a world where public cloud takes off, but it doesn't change internal IT architecture at all. I can't imagine that.
Right. I think the other big thing, too, is getting away from the separating ownership of private cloud as one thing and location of private cloud for another thing. Just because it's a private cloud doesn't mean it's inside the walls of a company.
Yeah.
It just means that a single resource, a single entity is owning that infrastructure.
And James Urquhart has a great, awesome video that does a nice 4x4 of all the things about control, location. He's done a whole study there. I won't even try to overdo that, but that's available.
So Gary, one thing, though, is I think that one thing we'll see out of Amazon, given that they're the feature leader in cloud these days, and I'm sure from other providers, is that level of control that you're talking about that's missing from today's public cloud, I don't think we'll be saying that a year from now. For example, I've got an issue where I need instances that are a little different from the 12 I can currently get out of EC2.
Right.
I bet there's going to be 16 of them, 25 of them, 16 different sliders all available if I want a little more network and a little more memory. All of those kinds of features and interactions are going to become available.
Yeah, actually, this is a real good point. In fact, I think 2010 will probably be the year where there's even more visibility into what's already out there, too. Because I think as we have these cloud brokers that are integrating more with these libraries that connect them to all these various clouds, and the cloud libraries are out there hunting the 10th or the 11th or the 12th cloud to integrate with, it becomes a lot easier to know what you can do. And I remember earlier this year, I think it was IronScale that I had a chat with, and they mentioned that they have a physical cloud provisioning, that basically they have, you know, racked hardware servers ready, you know, and you will get your bare bones operating system. And if you want to do something crazy, they will just block until somebody puts more memory into the machine for you. And essentially, you know, whatever you want, they will do it.
Right.
And so I thought that was a really kind of, you know, clever answer. And it really makes the API all the more important. Another discussion I followed on a Delta Cloud list was about, you know, profiles, because the idea of Amazon, they present you with instance types, which are basically profiles of hardware configuration. And, you know, a lot of these clouds, including vCloud Express API, allow you to select things individually.
Yeah.
Well, how do you know what you can select and how you can manage that in some sort of coherent fashion? So there's back and forth about, is it better to give everyone the, you know, dozen choices and say, if it's not here, you don't need it, just buy more? Or you have at the other end of the spectrum where if there's an option for blue blinky lights and customers keep asking me for it, well, I'm going to take that business.
Yeah.
And so I think this is really going to be one of the interesting takes. We'll see how that turns into APIs next year.
And my thinking is that public clouds are still dominated, maybe that's changing now, but by new applications and web-focused, cloud computing-focused guys who are getting started from scratch, whereas the private cloud, in my opinion, is still being driven largely by the same forces of traditional enterprise IT. And while the web might be driving innovation, the enterprise is driving the economy. And so I think that this whole you know, private cloud stuff is going to, people are going to understand definitions, use cases, and the money is going to start to pour in, perhaps even more so than the public cloud offerings.
I think it's another thing about best practices, too, because if we look at, you know, your public cloud story, if you're a startup and you want to get VC, then, you know, they're not really going to like the CapEx. But, you know, enterprises are often more concerned with best practices and adhering to standards and procedures. And if you've, you know, gone around several big companies, you know that how they orchestrate their internal IT is totally different from one-to-one-to-one.
Right.
So private cloud is as much a consistent story of best practices in IT and infrastructure that you happen to get when you move to private cloud. So it's sort of like a win. You can kind of step over here into this private cloud land and solve these latent problems that you've been living with for years.
And the final thing I say is there's products coming. So it's not like, hey, you should all just think this way. There's actual products coming.
Well, there's products now.
But there's really meaningful, hint, products in next year coming from the building we're sitting in, and I think that other companies too, and you saw Microsoft, who had said that Azure was going to be public, just a month ago announced, we might come out with the private.
We got a whole topic on that, so we'll jump into that later. Let's get into our next question. Of course, we're all on the same theme here. But one topic we discussed, Adrian, I want you to kick this off, is will we get a non-AWS ecosystem in 2010?
Well, yeah, this is a real interesting one. And honestly, I don't think we're going to get a tit-for-tat non-AWS ecosystem outside of maybe Eucalyptus. And I think the reason is that, you know, Amazon and the way that they choose the features that they offer are basically things they know they can do well. And when you look at things that are presented, they make sense when they're released. They fit their model. The APIs are somewhat consistent nowadays. If you look at it now, one thing that you see is that Amazon offers these various services, say, you know, RDB and this and that. Well, you know, maybe other people don't need to have each one of these services. Like, it's left to be seen, is Hadoop as a service, for example, really bringing them a lot of money. And I think that some companies, cloud companies, might choose not to go tit for tat for each of their services just because maybe they're not that successful. For one, I'm really curious as to how much money they make off of all of their various platforms.
Right.
And when they have that information out there, it may draw people to implement them tit for tat, or basically just go a completely different direction and say, I want a document-oriented NoSQL option instead, because I think that's going to bring me more money.
Right. It just seems to me now that you know, that's sort of the benchmark by which every service is measured. And I wonder if there's a way to, you know, everybody says, well, what, they've got that on AWS, so how are you different? You know, are we going to get away from AWS as the reference point?
Oh, yeah.
That's my question.
I think the first thing that has to happen, and what people have to understand, is behind the scenes, it's kind of tricky to actually create a cloud today. And so Adrian and I work all day long on actually standing up and working with companies to create clouds. There's a lot of scripting and XML and funky things that have to go on to actually operationalize all of that. And the reason why the products that are coming out are important is that it takes this from this, you need some really smart cutting edge people, because you can't go hire a cloud builder. I mean, there's a Randy Bias, there's four people in the world that can do it, right? But you can't really do it. And so the reason maybe EC2 has been so stellar out there is it was individual. But once you can, as any hosting provider, bring a cloud to market in 4 months, 3 months, I think it's going to really build out a different ecosystem, because I don't think it's going to turn to this monolith of the bookseller as computing provider to the world.
So you think there'll be enough people who'll come up, and are they going to differentiate now? Maybe not so much on the technical features and capabilities, but other kinds of service
offerings.
They're
going to differentiate.
Vertically specific,
yeah.
Industry specific.
Control, trust, and focus is the three ways that I would take down Amazon. They don't offer complete control of networking. They don't offer complete control of security. Trust, they say, trust us, hope for this SLA. We're not going to do a lot of HA or FT and the infrastructure layer. We're just going to hope for what we got, give you some nice stuff. They don't do anything bad. They don't do anything amazing. And then focus is that they're sort of generalists. So as you said, we could be regional. We could have relationships. We could be HIPAA. We could do something there.
Yeah.
One thing I would really like to see next year is that you have infrastructure clouds that have pluggable platforms. So essentially, you see little companies like or maybe they're not so little, but Mizeo, for example, they offer you an S3-like option that you can install on your cloud.
You can build a storage service provider, if I understand what their software.
You got it. Exactly. Right. So, and I think that next year, instead of necessarily going for all the services, it would be nice if I'm a hosting company that's looking to offer my, or re-offer my resources as a infrastructure cloud, to also say, okay, and we would like this portfolio of platforms. And they may match the local market or their particular target focus a little bit better than others. So if for example, your focus is on high security, maybe you're not getting a big demand for certain platforms that Amazon is offering that would just cost you more to run than wouldn't.
So my takeaway from what you guys are saying is that there's going to be enough commercial software available for service providers that'll spawn or enable enough people to start offering services in different markets, different segments, verticals, application types, that'll be the catalyst to sort of take all the discussion away from this AWS-only discussion.
Because it's also going to be if you look at the addressable market for that software, it's public and private. And so if you look at AWS as 40,000 servers and there's 30 million servers in the world, that software will be able to address all 30 million, whereas right now AWS can only consume them as they're migrated from one to the other.
The other thing to remember is that these APIs are not that difficult. Spin up, spin down, reserve, don't reserve, what's my IP address, what's my other IP address. These things, the reason people are using AWS and EC2 is because it's out there and it works and it has this broad range of functionality. In my test dev work, when I tried to do that on Rackspace, as much as I love their pricing and I love their latency and they've got a great product, it's very hard for me to share an image with someone at a completely different company. At least I would love to know how to do it if anyone's figured out how to do it. That's what I use every day at EC2, and I know how to do it. And so when offerings come out with the kind of flexibility and power that a single software company can bring to market, right, I think people will flock to it because the API load is really not that heavy.
Right? Yeah, that's a great point.
Go on. Yeah.
Next topic. So we talked about Seattle and the Amazon side. Let's flip to the other Seattle behemoth up there, Microsoft. And my thesis here is that I think we have seen the slow run-up and what I think is coming to a head in 2010 of the whole Microsoft environment. And I don't differentiate much between Microsoft, Windows, Azure, .NET, but the whole kit and caboodle, I think, is going to really have a big impact in 2010. And I just believe the reason is the pure conduit of once you've got a Windows development environment on one side and you've got the ability to either start with the same thing or move things over on the cloud side, whether it's Microsoft or Amazon's got Windows offerings and .NET offerings, Rackspace has got Windows and .NET offerings. I think that's the floodgates to really get the money that's been going into applications in the enterprise into the cloud, and I think it's going to be big in 2010. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think you've got a good point there. I mean, one of the things I think about cloud is that for some developers, I think there's some anxiety about, you know, do I know how to use the cloud? Am I going to end up, you know, spending my evening hours trying to figure out what it is? So if you have, you know, Microsoft, who have, you know, a fairly good story about, you know, development environments and making things pretty easy to use, have them deploy directly into their cloud, I think that's definitely going to put more money into the cloud, specifically Microsoft's, but it's going to put more money and put more people into the cloud and turn average developers into cloud developers.
Yeah, but it might not be exclusively Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft is doing as much as they can to enable other people to have Windows and, you know, similar offerings.
Well, in a way that's similar to Amazon, they do have differentiation that's applicable outside of the Microsoft market. I mean, one of the things that I found was the biggest surprises here for me API-wise is that here comes Microsoft's Azure storage services, and they're actually pretty good. And not only are they good, but they're much more, you know, thought through than everybody else's. Like, for example, when you look at what kind of data you can stick into Amazon S3, your bandwidth capped at 12 megabytes per second, and also, by the way, you can only stick 5 gigs in there at a time. And if you're you know, putting it in there and it stops at byte 49999, guess what? You got to restart. Microsoft has basically unlimited, and their architecture just is pretty well thought through. And I don't have to use any Microsoft software to use it. It's just REST. Mm-hmm. My biggest surprise was like, you know, here I am expecting to not like this, and it's great.
You know? I had the same experience this year, finally diving into C#. I needed to do it for a particular customer engagement. And same thing. There was a, you know, it's like Java, except it doesn't have all this ugly cruft in it. So maybe Microsoft is finding a model, a niche for themselves after being, you know, we are Windows and all that stuff. But, you know, we take the technology that sort of grows up altogether, and we make a nice stripped-down version of it that really works.
It seems like they're offering sort of whatever you want. I mean, I saw an announcement a couple weeks ago about Ruby on Rails, that you could run that on Azure. I mean, it's, to me, it's the strategy of, you know, run whatever you like. We're not going to get into too much of an argument there. Just have it, you know, we'll host it, right?
Yeah, and if things go as they are, I mean, they have a good portal. They've got a huge development base. You know, they're definitely sinking big dollars. I think Microsoft is going to, in 2010, add perhaps as much weight into the cloud as Amazon.
I think so too.
And I think it shows how big cloud is. Like, just like we were saying, that cloud is so big that private architectures can't escape it. Cloud is not small enough that the largest software company in the world can't change its business model. So I don't see it as like, oh, Microsoft's going to win cloud, or private cloud's going to win cloud, or, you know, Joe's Crab Shack's going to win cloud. I see it as the cloudification and sort of the cloud paradigm is taking over a lot of the market. So that's just another perspective on it, is it's not sort of winner take all. It's sort of like we're all sort of going there.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm not sure how many players are left to jump in. I think VMware is uniquely positioned because of their high technological basis in virtualization, which is the second cousin to cloud. And then you've got Amazon. I mean, why are they even there to begin with? They just happen to be a bookstore, but they happen to sink all this money in at a really interesting time. They were there. Okay, great. Microsoft, you know, and Oracle hasn't really made a splash. IBM runs on all their offerings on top of EC2.
Yeah.
Who's left to come
well,
in besides
but,
the
but that
players?
Gets back to the point earlier about once some of these commercial offerings are available for cloud infrastructure, it will spawn with no disrespect, sort of the tier two providers. So I agree, we're probably getting down to, like you say, a handful of tier one providers. But all the, whether it's regional specialties,
and they'll, but
vertical
they'll be running
specialties,
within, I think, say, the VMware ecosystem.
Or some other ecosystem.
Or some
right?
other, well, I'm even wondering, you know, how many are there out there. Because I'm hoping we get to the point where there's only four or five APIs.
Yeah.
And
four
I don't
most,
continually
please.
Have to think, oh, well, next year is the better cloud coming out, which is kind of where we're at this year. We have one huge cloud provider and a few more over the hill. I'm hoping next year everyone shows their cards and the market can settle out
yeah.
and become a bit bigger.
And fair point, Gary, which is that, you know, not every company in the world is going to become a major cloud provider, but of the big companies, they've all have to have a cloud story. And I think actually the heat has been on IBM pretty hardcore in terms of where's their story all year. And they've had a lot of press releases about it. They've had some analyst calls. And other than that, that's mostly global services engagements of helping other people build cloud. So I think ultimately IBM's story turns into private cloud. That's a little bit dangerous because if you look at what IBM's done historically of, oh, we'll implement other people's software, i.e. Microsoft, I'm just a little concerned of cloud becoming PC part two for them if they don't have a lot of software IP in it.
Well, I'm really curious about, you know, your mobile providers and telcos and whether they're going to be these that next big players to step in and take on some of these.
AT&T?
Yeah, example, right?
Is any iPhone user going to sign up for the AT&T cloud?
Not an iPhone user.
I'm not either, but
but that's one thing I think is a
AT&T
natural progression.
AT&T has a very nice vCloud, Gary. Thank you.
When you talk about who's good at metering services on a minute by minute basis, I mean these sorts of infrastructures are important. Networks are important.
No, I think there is something to be said there that the telcos have service and service billing ingrained into their culture.
Yeah,
it's
right
not something
bone.
That they had to invent. Or recreate, or have an offsite to figure out.
You got it.
It's been built in. All right. I want to end with one topic, and I want to change the pace a little bit because one of the benefits of starting this podcast was that cloud computing stretches from the business side all the way to the consumer side and the apps that we use every day. And my question to the roundtable here is: do we need desktop apps anymore?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah, and I think if you don't believe that we need them, then you can bet on Chrome and you can bet on ARM. So go buy a bunch of ARM people right now, because they're going to, and not bet, everything's just going to be in Google Chrome, and Google Chrome's going to be predominantly on ARM. It's going to, you know, try to subvert Intel.
Right.
So that's how they play that, but I don't believe that's the case. And I think if you look at the netbook market, everyone wanted Windows. Like, it started off as a lightweight Linux
browser. But why did they want Windows?
Because they can install Skype, because they can install whatever they want. They can, all the apps that they already had, even random app XYZ, it's the classic long tail. Who knows what people have on their desktops, but they want to have it, and they don't want to give it up.
So my problem is simply, as an end user, the experience and the difference in experience. When I'm dealing with a web-oriented application through a browser portal, there's only so much the UI can do. And I think Google has led the way in improving the experience all the way from the very first Google Earth applications and, you know, taking huge advantage of DHTML. And, you know, Google Documents is still awful. Absolutely awful compared to Word. I would rather do all my typing in Word and have it come out just right and then cut and paste it over there. It's a simple user experience issue. And we've been living this for 20 years. The entire problem of how abstract can you be and then, you know, and still get a great user experience, that hasn't changed in 20
years. I love the Google Apps thing, because to me, Google Apps said, you know what? It's much more important for you to get something simple, down on paper, and worrying about sharing, collaboration, and facilitation than designing something that was all fancy and had all these extra bells and whistles on the Word front.
I agree. I love it. I'd say it's a great way of doing collaboration. It's not such a great way of doing document creation. And one other thing I'll say here is, does everybody know how much Atom actually costs?
The Atom chip compared to an Intel standard Pentium chip.
It costs Intel like $8 with the motherboard. So
versus a Core Duo, which is...
Well, that might cost them $50.
Okay.
But the point is that even Atom has enough strength to run local desktop applications. So how are you going to disrupt the market where to run local applications costs all of $8 for the silicon?
So you're saying that in between the browser-only experience and the Intel Core Duo on your laptop experience is this middle experience, which will give you a little bit of desktop capability and power, but... and generally move a little bit away from some of the heavyweight nature.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, you're not going to run Photoshop on Atom. But what I'm saying is there's not much room to be cheaper than $8, which is a moderately good processor.
I tell you what, I think JavaScript engines have gotten really good this year, and I think that the Chrome is an interesting story. I don't think we're in a place where in 2010 we're going to see large migrations, but I'd like for us to talk about it again next year, because... When you look at how much research and how much progression there is, and you know how few browser crashes you have now versus the beginning of 2009, things are a lot better. And it'd be interesting to see where we go with this.
I'm just calculating the time it takes me to queue up a new laptop every time I want to change something, and I'm trying to go all browser all the time.
I'm
not there yet, but I'm pulling for it.
Cool.
And with that, let's call it a wrap for this show. This is great. I think we're going to have to do this one again sometime soon.
Cool.
So let's jump into the final. Before we do that, did we miss any major topics that anybody wanted to just chime in? Maybe we'll save it for another show, or did we cover just about everything we had to?
All I want to say is there's a lot of doubt around cloud in 2009, too, and I think it kept proving itself in terms of actual implementation, actual products, actual facts.
Yeah, I did. You can't fight the tape.
Yeah, I mean, it really, cloud just kept being, everyone kept saying, oh, hype. You know, the middle of the summer, Gartner said it's the most hyped thing ever, so it's about to fall off. And in November, they said it's the number one technology of 2009. So what are you going to do?
It's in.
Let's jump into the last section of the show. We call it Cloud Tips, where we pick a consumer or business-facing product, service, company to share with the listeners. And James, why don't you kick it off?
I saw a demo the other day of Instratus that George Reese created, and I would say anyone who's deploying a web app or a batch processing app or any kind of app to the cloud, it's a multi-cloud deployment and management environment. And I thought it was great, and I think it showed how much you can do with at a cloud API control layer. with a relatively small development team. So if you're going to go deploy a cloud website, for instance, it won't go down. It'll migrate you from one cloud to the other. If, you know, this classic Rackspace is down problem that they're having over at TechCrunch, if they're written on Stratus, that would probably be at most a 3-minute downtime.
But they're then paying for that reliability, of course, in having the second cloud available. But in Stratus, will manage the failover.
It'll manage the failover, and I do not believe that you'd have to be up the entire time in the other one. It'll spin it up.
Nice. Yeah.
One of the things I like about that also is that it allows you to decouple yourself from accounts. I mean, one of the things in talking about cloud, a lot of people complain about is like, I don't really want to have everyone who uses my services have to like log into Amazon and create an account and blah blah blah. And I also don't want to give them the master keys to like shut down everything in my organization just to allow them to start and stop one thing. And you know, this is not the only tool that does that, but I think it does it in a pretty nice way. So.
Great, Adrian. How about your pick?
Yeah. So James talked about the Flightcaster earlier, the one that helps you figure out whether you're going to be late or not. And interestingly, they open sourced part of their tooling that makes their lives easier, and it's called Crane. And what Crane does is it allows you to do some scripting to manage your Amazon resources like S3 and EC2 and maybe execute some SSH commands. And one of the things I think is also, you know, interesting this year in the last couple is, you know, the amount of new languages that people are using to do their jobs. One of the newer ones is Clojure. So this is written in Clojure, which is a very succinct language, and it looks and feels very nice for sysadmins.
Great. Brian, do you have a cloud tip?
Well, yes and no. My cloud tip would be Netflix. So pure consumer. It doesn't look like there's any cloud underneath, but my information is that they're porting their entire recommendation and personalization system to the cloud.
Yeah.
So when you'll be using Netflix, you'll be using the cloud.
That's interesting. You know, they've had that history of doing all these various contests for people to come up with better algorithms for what you might like.
A big data company.
So a big data company. I wonder if they will then open up their APIs for personalization so that with the proper privacy guards, God knows what they are, but...
Yeah, but the thing to me that it starts seeing is if they've got all that data there in the cloud, then the contest participants now can actually run on the real stuff, and the participants are going to know how to use some of these services that are...
That kind of work is already being done in advertising bidding, where there are bid infrastructures where anyone can come in and start bidding for ads as a provider. So the same kind of personalization, all of that depends on virtualized environments and cloud-hosted style deployments.
So Adrian's chick flicks are going to be outed.
My pick is back to our conversation about desktop apps. I'm picking Chrome for Mac. Finally got it in 2009, just under the wire. I'm slowly transitioning over it as much as possible. I think that the interesting thing here is that Google has said or taken it upon themselves that their mission is to speed up the entire web. And I do love the fact that they're showcasing tools and tricks and educating people about how to design better web pages. Ultimately, given that they have monopoly market share on the advertising market, you know, the rising tide helps them first and foremost. So I don't think it's purely altruistic, but I do think it does help us have a better browsing experience as the person sitting there in front of the screen. So I vote Chrome for Mac.
Installed it yesterday.
There you go. That's it for the show. We'll do a quick wrap-up. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll do sign-offs. You can let people know where to find you. James, go ahead.
Hi, I'm James. You can find me at WatersJames on Twitter.
Adrian?
Yep, at JClouds on Twitter.
Twitter, that would be bbulkow, B-B-U-L-K-O-W, or citrusleaf.net.
And for me, Gary Ornstein, you can find me at thecloudcomputingshow.com. You can also email the show with questions, comments, and requests for Google Wave invites. We have a few of those sticking around. I did get a request last week based on the last show, so we'll let people know in case anybody doesn't have an invite. thecloudcomputingshow@gmail.com, and you can subscribe at iTunes by just doing a quick search for The Cloud Computing Show. Happy holidays and New Year to everybody. We'll see you in 2010. And hopefully in the next roundtable sometime in January or February. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.